This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
I'm very excited to introduce Manal al-Sharif. In 2001, Manal, a women's rights activist from Saudi Arabia, was imprisoned in the kingdom for driving. In her new book, Daring to Drive, she not only describes that terrible ordeal, but also chronicles her life as a woman in Saudi Arabia. Manal's story is nothing short of extraordinary, having persevered in the face of such adversity. And I say that not only as someone who has already read the book, but I actually also grew up in Dhahran, Saudi Arabia, albeit under very different circumstances. Manal's book is already garnering widespread acclaim. The Washington Post wrote, Daring to Drive is brave, extraordinary, heartbreakingly personal story of one woman's battle for equal rights. Kirkus Reviews described it as an intimate and powerful book from what is hopefully only the first of many Saudi voices to speak out. I told you it was extraordinary. So without further ado, please help me in welcoming Manal al-Sharif to Politics and Prose.
I think all the good people been to Dhahran. Michael been to Dhahran. Good evening, everyone. Assalamu alaikum. That means peace be upon you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Good. I look awkward this way. Like I have a big nose. Yes, I'll do that. It's a beautiful city. And I came from New York. You can understand. I just love Washington. I've been here in 2009. And I did all the Smithsonian, all the museums, because we don't have museums back home. So for me, it's amazing. And growing up in Saudi Arabia, I grew up in ultra-conservative society where women are not allowed to leave the house. It's thrown at us. So we're always locked. And even if you want to leave the house, it has to be urgent for urgent thing. And you need to ask permission from the man. So my life was spent amongst books. I love books, and it was like living other lives reading these books. And I hope when you read my story in I wrote about my passion about books in this, but I never thought I'm gonna publish my own book. I've always wanted to write my story. I've always wanted people to know my story, but I never knew why would anyone read my insignificant life. It took only, it was 2011 when I was sent to jail for starting a movement. I've been always an activist, and I didn't know I was an activist. I've been always speaking against wrongdoing, standing up for the things I believe in, and I knew I was an activist when I was sent to jail. So I call, there's an Arab here. So I call myself the accidental activist. And when people come to me and call me an activist, I always say, when we call people who speak up activists, we single them out. It should be the norm that everyone, when you see something wrong, you speak against it. It should not be the exception. We should be all activists. Thank you really for being here today. I'm so overwhelmed. I know you're all book lovers, and you know how much beautiful when you read your favorite book or an interesting book, because I don't finish the boring books. I hope my book, I've heard so much that it's a page turner. It was written with tears. The recording. It took me 6 years, this book, to write. Not because it was difficult. I know my life. The secret is to have a good agent and a good collaborator. I had 4 bad collaborators. And then I'm like, I gave up. I rented a beach house. I was pregnant, 9 months pregnant, and 6 months pregnant. And I sit down for two. I've always written. I always wrote stories, blogged, but in Arabic, my diary. And I sat and I wrote it in Arabic. And I translated it to English. That's when my 5th beautiful, amazing collaborator. I don't know if Lyric is here. Lyric? Oh my God, she's here. This amazing, amazing collaborator shows up in my life. I didn't have belief in you, Lyric. I'm so sorry for that. Because I lost hope with 4 terrible collaborators. And my Izzy is here.
Hi.
She's from Saudi.
Hi,
she's one of my best friends. Thank you for being here.
Thank
And it turned out that the book happened. Finally, after 6 years, it's here. And yesterday was the release day, and it was another birthday for me. June 13 was another birthday. When I wrote the book, I wrote it in a chronological order, where I started from the time I was born, which is was 1979. Yes, I'm 38 years old. And I started from that year, because that year, it wasn't only the year I was born, but it was also the year that the monster was born in the Islamic world. And that is the radical Islam. So my world moved to radical Islam from that year, from 79. Saudi Arabia was going through modernization, and the siege of Mecca happened in that year, where there was uprise. I see some people nodding. This is interesting to see people know about this story. There was uprise for the Sunni Islam, the extreme Islam, or the ultra, I wouldn't even call it ultra, I would call it the Orthodox Islam, in Saudi Arabia, where there was a group of jihadis. They went to the holiest place for Muslims, which is the Holy Mosque, the Grand Mosque in Mecca, and it was under siege. They locked the doors. There were 120,000 pilgrimage. It was exactly 1 week after the 2 weeks after the pilgrimage finished, with the start of the new Hijri year. That story, you will find it in my book. There's a whole chapter about it, Mecca under siege, really shaped the future of that generation, shaped today. That story, when it began, as I said, the Saudi Arabia was going through modernization, but because of that uprise, and also the uprise of the Shia Islam in Iran, which is also the year of revolution, I call it the year of trouble. There were two competing powers, the Sunni and the Shia, and everyone wants to be the dominant power in the Muslim world. So they used everything they could to be the prominent voice of Islam in the Muslim world. The king asked his ulama, when the Holy Mosque was under siege, he was traumatized, the country was traumatized, what to do to stop this from happening again. They killed the beast. They ended the siege after 2 weeks. They executed everyone who were involved in the siege of Mecca with the leader, Juhayman. But the king, because he was traumatized, he asked his advisors and ulama what to do to stop this from happening again. Guess what was the answer? To listen to their demands, so you don't face another uprise. So women were removed from TV. Our pictures were removed from newspapers and magazines. I don't know, Izzy, I don't think you passed by this. We used to receive these magazines, and they have this black marker. They go through all the faces of the women.
I've seen that.
Oh, you've seen that? Oh, my God. Who has the time to do that? He must be very bored. So they also cracked down on the employment of women. That happened in the year 79. That was the year I was born. And that year I was born, the generation who came in the 80s, who grew up in the 80s and the 90s, we were faced with a very, I would say, hardcore preaching for the ultra-conservative Islam with the Wahhabi Salafi interpretation of the Islamic text. This is what we found out years later after radicalizing the youth, or my generation, and I was one of them. I was the one who distributed these leaflets that calls for the hate for the non-believers or the infidels, who calls for the death for the non-believers, who calls for the women to cover tip to toe and submit to the men, stay home, only go out for the really, really urgent things. Things like not only the hate, things against, for example, listening to music. Things against taking photos, taking pictures. All these things we were taught, they were sins. I was brought up in that era. They call it the awakening or the sahwa. I call it the fall. So that was the time I grew up, and I talk about it, how I became someone who is strange for her own family. because I was the one, my generation, this is an interesting thing, my generation, we enforced these strict Islamic laws in our own families. So you find the whole family there, one of them is a crazy one like me, who wants to enforce the did you have that in your family?
No, luckily not.
Yeah, she grew up in Dhahran. She didn't grow up in Mecca, which is the most conservative city in Saudi Arabia with Qasim. So we would enforce our parents to follow these strict laws, these strict. So you never covered your face?
No.
I can't believe this. She was the lucky one. She grew up in Dhahran. Dhahran, by the way, is built by Aramco, which is an American company that started the production of oil in Saudi Arabia. And they were the infidels.
That's true.
They had TV that we didn't have. They had their own TV in Aramco. We had only one channel in Mecca, or in all of Saudi Arabia, except the Eastern province. So growing up in this atmosphere, growing up in this era, there were a lot of contradictions. One of the contradictions that they tell us that pictures are haram, and then the banknote of our currency had the king's picture.
Yeah.
Right? And then they tell us that music is haram, and when we open TV, it starts with the national anthem with music. They say that cannot talk to men, you cannot even mix with men. And we see the king, he's Margaret Thatcher, he go and he's shaking her hand. So the contradictions were really high for us. We didn't understand. Good, I'm seeing there are kids here, so there are things I'm not going to talk about. The contradiction started by comparing the things they preach in schools. We had 60% of our schooling. 60% of what we used to study was going to only religious subjects. So there was heavy preaching even in the school. Even if you're not studying it, if you go to the mosque, if you go to the mall, we didn't have malls at that time. If you go to the souk, which is like a mall today, open a mall. If you go to anywhere, you will find free leaflets and free cassettes giving away to you that preach this. I remember my aunt once said, I'm very thankful for my children. They're teaching me the true Islam. My own aunt, she says this, that her children is teaching her the true Islam. I move away from that, and you will read in my book how education, the internet, really changed the way I look to life, and it did change the way the youth in my country, or my generation, look at life. Because we had only, I wouldn't call it a window, I would call it a hole, that all the information come from. And the internet and the education and getting books, because it's heavily censored, the books in Saudi Arabia. Certain books cannot enter Saudi Arabia. We couldn't watch, we didn't have satellite dish at that time. When the satellite dish was invented, Saudi Arabia banned it. The ban, by the way, until this day, the ban is valid. They didn't cancel that ban. So we don't watch the infidels. We don't corrupt our beliefs. We watch only Ghasb Wahid, which we call it, mean Ghasb Wahid, the Arab understands, means enforced one. So we had one channel, we call it Ghasb, يعني enforced, صح?
Yeah.
Yes, I'm just checking my language. We had one channel to watch, one channel. Suddenly with the internet, we had access to this. We had a window that we get more information, the other side of the story about Islam, about other cultures. That was huge for us, and that really started creating the change. My story, I don't think it's a personal thing. It's a story of many shared. I joined Aramco with Michael, spent 10 years of his beautiful childhood there. And in Aramco, imagine outside, women cannot drive. I have to wear abaya, black abaya. Don't tell me you didn't wear black abaya, is it? Thankfully, oh my God. I'm just like, oh my God, where did this girl live? Imagine you cannot mix with men anywhere. In the malls, in the cafes, in the restaurants, in the banks, in the government offices, you name it. We enter from the back doors of every place we go, whether the bank, whether a government office, whether any place. women had tiny, tiny place at the back. We were banned from public events. For example, this public event, I was banned from it. I couldn't go. Women were not allowed in public libraries. My first public library card, I got it when I moved to the state to work in 2009 in Nashua. I still keep that card, and I still keep my membership until this day. Although I don't live there anymore. But this is how difficult it was for me growing up as a woman. When I moved to Aramco, everything changed. Everything is different. Aramco is a company that started in 1933 by Texaco. They were looking for oil in Saudi Arabia. So they signed a concession agreement with King Abdulaziz, who is the founder of Saudi Arabia. And they had to build their own community, gated community. In the 80s, the Saudis bought it and it became Saudi company, but they kept the culture behind these gates. It's one of, actually it is the biggest gated city in the whole world, is Dhahran. It's around 15,000 more. I don't have the numbers. Around 15,000 families or 15,000 people, residents?
Units maybe. It's pretty big.
It's really big. We have our own hospital, golf course, theaters, yes, cinema. Cinemas are banned in Saudi Arabia. In Aramco, it's not banned. Women can drive. Women don't have to wear abaya. Women ride bikes, can go to swimming pools. There is drinking, too, by the way. Yes, inside the camp, inside Aramco camp. And it was a military base camp. This is why they kept the name camp. I was talking to Michael about the commissary. And a commissary, you know, if anyone is in the army, is a place where they get the food. So we still call the supermarket in Aramco the commissary. They kept the name. So when I worked in Aramco, that was in Saudi Arabia. I remember when we passed through the gate, we entered Saudi Aramco, and I saw a woman driving a car next to me and another woman on her bike. I was asking the driver, are we in Saudi Arabia? Did we leave the country? I swear to God. And he said, yes, you're still in Saudi. And I was mesmerized. And that really, the contradiction here, it's not anymore a picture on a banknote. It's something I can see in front of me. That when the questioning started in my life. I'm jumping between chapters. There are chapters I didn't talk about. But there's this chapter where you will start the book with, that was my arrest. So in 2011, this ultra-conservative Muslim became an accidental activist. In 2011, it was the Arab Spring. Everyone remembers the Arab Spring. And they use social media in very innovative ways. They use social media. People here use it to get to know each other, get to connect with old friends. The Arabs used it to start revolutions and push for social change. That was very inspiring to me and a lot of people. The idea was simple. To use the prominent social media in your country, call a day of action, and people and tell them what to do on that day of action, and people go out in the street or have hunger strike or have stand for whatever they believe. My problem that time, I just came from the U.S. I got my driver's license at the age of 30. And I had a car that I was paying its installment for 4 years. I can only drive it in the gated community. Once I reach the gate, I have to park it, hire a man, pay him daily, or I have to take a car outside. And it's a Cadillac, by the way. Like, I paid a lot of money for that Cadillac. One day it was 9 p.m. I left my clinic in the city, and I couldn't find a car going back home. I called. We have a huge list of taxi drivers and private drivers that we exchange, you know, like drug dealers, you exchange. Sorry for the kids. We exchange the driver numbers, like we put them in the speed dial. I called every drug dealer, every driver I know. Every driver I know. I called my brother. I called my friends, you know, when you don't even find the drivers, you call the male colleagues, because I worked in Aramco where women can work with men, only company at that time. And no one picked up. And it was 9 p.m. I'm the one who, I uncovered my face. You will reach that part in my life when I uncovered my face. I stopped wearing the niqab. And no one showed up. So I had to walk from my clinic to the nearest mall, which is a Rashid Mall, to find a taxi. As I was walking, it was late at night, and it was a woman alone. Most of the shops on that street were closed. The cars harassed me. One of them even followed me. And I got so scared and so mad. There was a construction area where I found a rock, and I had to throw it in this guy while I was shaking, because I felt like I'm going to get kidnapped. I was 32 years old. The car, he ran away. But that moment, I broke in tears. I was so mad that my car is there. I have a driver's license in my pocket, in my wallet, and I couldn't drive my own car just because I'm a woman. That was one of the the straw that broke the camel's back. And because 2011, the Arab Spring was going on, it was a simple idea. Let's start a movement that calls women to drive on a certain day. And it was June 17, which is coming in 3 days. That's our sixth anniversary. As simple as that, we had no clue that this movement will gain momentum. Of course, we received a lot of opponents, a lot of people attacking it. We needed to encourage women to go out and drive because this never happened. We hear about women being driven and she got arrested, but we've never seen it. One crazy person had to take the lead. And I told one of my friends, how about we drive in the city, we take a video and post it on YouTube. Why YouTube? Again, use the social media that's most prominent in your country. YouTube is the most used. We are number one nation in the world when it comes to YouTube video views per capita. More than you, US, more than Brazil. 90 million views per day, Saudi Arabia. And I got the statistics from YouTube themselves because I spoke to them last year. I'm like, I thought it's a hoax. I'm getting it from YouTube themselves. When I posted it, it was trending, that video. It got 700,000 views in one day. It was brought up when I was sent to jail after war. They had to bring it down, but it was like popping up everywhere like mushroom. They took the video. The second time when I drove, it was trending in Saudi Arabia. I received a lot of threats for this YouTube video. One threat I received, it was a phone call, and he said, you opened your grave. You opened the door to hell, he said. You opened fitna. Translate? She's my translator. Fitna is like riot. It's like disorder. That's fitna. I was really scared, and I was thinking what will happen to the woman who will drive on June 17. And I needed to know what the authority think. Because when I drove, no one stopped me in the street. Men looked at me with like, they're not believing. They're disbelieving. There's a woman driving. I was like, oh my God, this is not happening. But no one stopped me. I needed to know what the authority thinks. So I drove again with my brother this time in his car. I was smart. See, my car kept it in the cab. When I wanted to get arrested, I used my brother's car. So he came with me. I drove and I asked him to pass by a police car, a traffic police car. He was very supportive, by the way. And I passed by a police car to be stopped, and he called the Azira. It was a Hyundai Azira. And we stopped, and the guy was smiling to me. He comes to me, and it was my brother next to me, and he's like, do you know that women can't drive in Saudi? I'm like, but the law, and it's true, the law doesn't specify the gender of the driver. And he just smiled and like, give me a driver license. No, you don't have a driver license. You cannot drive without a driver license. I do have a driver license, and I show my American driver license. And the guy says, but you have to have a Saudi driver license. I'm like, great, because I have the application. We can go and get the driver's license. I was prepared, because I was prepared for that moment. Some nice citizen called the religious police, and anyone who doesn't know, Saudi Arabia is one of the last countries in the world where it has religious police or moral police that monitors your behavior, the dress code, the leaving, closing the shops at the prayer time. They call them. Now the moral police, driving a car became a moral issue. They took me to the traffic police. I was interrogated. I was released. 2 a.m. in the morning, they came back to my house in Aramco, which police cannot enter. Secret police, they were sent 2 a.m. They arrested me. I was interrogated and I was sent to jail. And I remember when the woman, she had my papers on the table. I remember when she was getting the keys, I looked at the paper. When I was sent to jail, no one told me why. I looked at the paper and it says, driving while female. By the way, the prison guard, she couldn't believe it herself. I spent 9 days. My story became international news, and I'm thankful for the international rally. That really led to my release from jail. Izzy is part of the whole story. She booked Dad a ticket to drive to fly him all the way from Jeddah. Thank you, Izzy.
You're welcome.
To where I was in prison. And then she booked him back to go and meet the king himself and ask for a pardon for his daughter that drove a car. Yes. The story goes on. The struggle goes on. We did not stop campaigning. The main reason a lot of people ask me why women don't drive, because I know someone here in the audience is going to ask why women don't drive. I say it's two reasons. Men prejudice and women submission. Men always thought of us, we have to be obedient. Our place is the house. And we are considered minors in need of protection. They call us queens. That's why we need protection of men. We need to take their permission. And we call it the country of one king and millions of queens. The only country in the world. The submission of women, because we did believe, we wanted to please God, really, not men. So whatever they told us, it was like, this is God asked you to do this. So the submission of men made them give up a lot of their rights because they believe it's God's will that I don't drive. It's God's will I need to ask the man permission to leave the house or to cover up or to not pursue my higher education because it's God's will. That's the reason I think women don't drive today. And women can, they have so much power, they just don't realize it yet. We can really change the world. Things are changing in Saudi Arabia. There's another movement called My Own Guardian. The guardianship system or the male guardianship system, it's very difficult to explain to someone who didn't live it. But the movement goes on, and My Own Guardian is to end the male guardianship system, which is the reason, one of the main reasons that women don't drive, that women are only 14% of the workforce in Saudi Arabia. Because they get higher education. Izzy is here for her master's degree. Women in Saudi Arabia are highly educated, but they're deprived from finding a job. And for a woman to be financially independent is number one step in her liberation, really. Don't give up that.
It's, I guess, the age-old question, but hard for us to understand. And I've lived in three Muslim countries, though not Saudi Arabia. I judge it's very difficult for us heretics to get into Saudi.
Infidels.
you're right, infidels. Sorry. But Mohammed, first wife was independent. She hired him, as I recall.
She proposed to him.
Oh, even proposed.
Yes.
Where did all of this come from? And why is it that whenever something goes wrong, they take it out on the women, even though the men usually cause it?
Okay. Men issues is really a global issue. It's not Saudi Arabia issue, it's not third world issue, it is a global issue. There is a war that's declared on women. And women through history been always the one who pay the highest price, women and minorities. In Saudi Arabia, I think when Islam was used to gain political power, so it moved the interpretation of Islamic texts, it was moved away from its original meaning. The Muslims woman, actually Islam when it came, it gave women at that time things like the inheritance, the right to divorce herself, gave her a lot of rights that she was deprived from before Islam. Mm-hmm. The problem, and women were scholars, they led wars, women were leaders. They were pioneers. They started a lot of things that men couldn't start. The problem is with the through history when the scholars started removing women. So all the textbooks that we receive, all the interpretation of the text of the Islamic texts we receive, it's coming only from men, from the male perspective, and the female perspective was removed. And when you remove the female perspective, if I get to write a law and I'm a man and I don't put in my consideration the woman, believe me, I'll put it in to serve my own, my best benefit. Yes, my best interest. I'll put it for me. If I given the full power to write any law and it serves my own benefits, of course I'll put it for the best. And I think this is what happened. It's very complicated, but in Saudi Arabia, the more they want to show control over society is through women. The more they have the grip over women, that means we have Islamic, because we are the birthplace of Islam, Saudi Arabia. So this is, you show the rest of the world, this is the role model, the Saudi woman. This is very important to change the status quo of the Saudi woman. It does change the status quo for the Muslim woman. Because as the birthplace of Islam, we are the role model for the rest of the Muslim world. So this is what the country tried to keep, that we keep our woman under control, not anymore. But anyway, so I think this is what happened. Thank you for the question.
Thank you for a fascinating presentation.
Thank you.
Every audience has a stupid question, so here it is.
There's no question called a stupid question.
You understand why all of us here are surprised by the level of what we would call repression.
Yes.
Why isn't there more revolt?
When I say God wants this in a conservative and a devoted society, it is difficult to revolt against that. I sit with a lot of my girlfriends, and when we discuss, she always like, I cannot discuss this. God says this. God says this. God okay. says this. So when you say God, and you cannot pass it through your mind to question it, because we're not allowed to question it, it's very difficult to break out of it.
Thank you. That answers a lot.
Yes.
Hello, I lived in Saudi Arabia in 1979 to 1982 in Hafuf, and I was at King Faisal University, the first and only women's college in the Eastern Province, and I just want to totally take my hat off to you because I've been there, and it resonates so much with me. Your experience of being there. And I guess my question is, how do you see yourself as an activist outside of Saudi? Because I know that it probably is still very dangerous for you to be in Saudi.
I do go back to Saudi because I have my son there.
Mm-hmm.
I hope they don't arrest me. I keep speaking up because it's the only way. You cannot, when you start something, you can have two options. Either to give up when nothing happens or to continue and hope that will be change happening, even if it's not in my lifetime, for the next generation. And I always use Susan B. Anthony. She's one of my role models. I always use her example. When I saw the girls go on the election day and they said, I voted today, and I knew that Susan B. Anthony, she fought for the right to vote, but she never got it. But the woman after her got it. That, for me, the second option. So I could be get arrested when I go back home, but I think I would choose the second option to continue. Speaking up, someone needs to challenge the system. If we're all afraid to speak up, if we're all afraid to challenge the system, nothing will change. That answer your question too. Why things didn't change until now.
I'd like to say that you are a very courageous woman, and I'm very honored to be here tonight.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Could you comment on how Christians are treated in Saudi?
Christians, I had Christian friends working in Aramco. You're not allowed to build a church in Saudi Arabia, all of Saudi Arabia, although the Islamic text says only Mecca and Medina. It didn't specify all of the Arabian Peninsula. They cannot show any signs of their faith. That's Christian or non-Christian. If you're Hindu, if you're Jew, if you're... Actually, Jews are not even allowed in Saudi Arabia. If you're Hindu, Saudi Arabia, if you're Christian, you cannot even show the sign. Or Buddhist, you cannot even show the sign of your religion. Unfortunately, this is one of the things we try to still tackle in Saudi Arabia, which is the freedom of expression and freedom of belief. And it's very difficult situation when it comes to non-Muslims when they move to Saudi Arabia to work and they cannot practice their beliefs. But they're not insulted because we, as Muslims, we respect Jesus and we believe in Jesus and we respect the Bible. It's just the Bible is not allowed to enter Saudi Arabia. You cannot have your Bible with you when you go there.
Even in Aramco, you can't have it.
No, actually, you can smuggle it. So Aramco, you have... So you can do smuggle these things.
Thank you.
But you could get fined and arrested for if they find it with you.
How you say you were very conservative as a young person. How did you get the job at Aramco? How did you dare to go? How did your family let you?
I kept the the sense of mystery. I kept it for the book. Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
You will find out when you read the book.
What about female circumcision? Is that still practiced in Saudi?
I don't know if I can say I'm proud or I'm not proud. I'm the first woman in my country that speaks against it in this book because there's a denial. Female genital mutilation is usually a practice that is done in secrecy, and the victims are ashamed and embarrassed to speak up that they have gone under the knife. And in Saudi Arabia, my family, Al Sharif family, they practice it in their daughters. But when you go and ask the girls, they deny. That's a problem. The other thing, there are certain cities and enclaves in Saudi Arabia where they still practice it. Even in the south, like a city like Jizan, they do it twice. They circumcise the girl when she's born, and the circumciser a few years later. The problem is the government doesn't recognize that this exists because they need to criminalize it and they need to punish who circumcised their daughters. I hope this book will open the door for more people to come up and speak against it because this never happened in my country. They think it's a North African issue. We have nothing. There are 200 million girls being circumcised in this world. That's the size of Brazil, the largest country in South America. There is one woman every hour reported circumcised in UK. Not in Somalia, not in Egypt, in the UK. So it is an international problem. The problem is being in denial and shutting up the people who try to stop this and fight it.
Is it part of Sharia law?
Is it? No, has nothing to do with Sharia law. It's an African practice. In Egypt, you find the Christian and the Muslims, both of them practice it. Yes.
Hi. Well, first, I just want to thank you so much for your bravery and for serving as a role model to girls and women around the world.
Wow.
And like everyone else, I'm so honored to be here. My question is, what would you say to people who push back on the notion that global women's issues are deeply related to local women's issues? And how do you convey to others that no woman is empowered unless we're all empowered?
Amazing question. She must have spent half an hour writing it for me because it's even beautifully written. You mean the global issue for women's rights and the local issue? And their correlation or their really, I always say women's right anywhere in the world is women's rights everywhere in the world. You fight here in the US for the right to vote or for the right for equal pay or for the right for paid maternity leave. Other women get inspired when you get that right. Other women learn from you. Other women go and fight for the same right. It is a global issue, and it's not disconnected. It is connected all around the world. The second part of the question, it was so complicated, so sophisticated, I would say.
Less eloquently put, I guess I'm just trying to say, I know people will push back on, or people can say that this is an issue that is someone else's issue,
yes,
and it's not ours. We have issues here, and, you know, let's prioritize those. But, you know, clearly they're not mutually exclusive. So I just, you know, what would you say to people like that, just so we all have the right language to...
I think it's fine, because priorities are different. For example, girls come to me and say, why the right to drive? I say, because you don't understand. It is priority for me because it's emancipate women. It gives them independence and liberty. They have to experience that to end the guardianship system. Priority is different. And I totally understand when some people say, this is not my cup of tea. Totally okay. The problem is when... the problem is not the that you don't want to involve. The problem is when you support countries that is terrible when it comes to women's rights, like what Ivanka Trump said when she said, I find the progress in women's rights in Saudi Arabia encouraging. Yes, she actually said that. I'm not making it up in the last visit. And that's the problem. So when you have your own priority, I totally respect that. The problem is when you either attack the people who try to change or say this is not priority, or when you encourage countries like my country, which is, we're ranked 141st out of 144 countries in the world when it comes to the Global Gender Gap Index. What are you talking about? It doesn't exist women's rights in my country to say the progress is encouraging. So that's the problem. That's when I face a problem. Yes. Good question. Yes, I can come to you. They can bring the microphone to you.
Shortest route to it. Sorry about that. So this is sort of, I think this question follows up on the question that you were just asked. One of the things that I remember hearing about all of the time when I was a student, and one of the things that I hear about sometimes, you know, sort of being an American with, being a Westerner with family in the not West, right, is this question of feminism and Western values being imposed on places that, you know, sort of the question of universal values versus Western values. So in my case, that would be the imposition of Western feminism on Hindu Indian culture, right? Or something like that. And so what I'm wondering is, how does that conversation, or does that conversation play out in conversations, in activist conversations in places like Saudi, where do, you know, when you say women's rights everywhere are women's rights, you know, is that, do you get the accusation of that being Westernized?
You've talked to my opponent, apparently. So I've been called Westernized. I've been called a conspiracy from the West. It's totally normal to attack a woman who speaks up. When you talk about imposing whatever values, whatever beliefs that you have, your belief system, on other cultures, this is what you mean?
Yeah, and really, I mean, not to sound like your opponent, what I'm trying to get your help with or advice on is how to respond to that critique, right?
Yes.
I don't so much want to level it as to say, what do you say to people when they say that, and how does it work? How well does it work?
It depends what it comes from, because when it comes from people who has no, they just want to attack, I just totally ignore. Because for them, when I call for freedom, and I explain to them, my freedom is to live with dignity. Mm-hmm. They say, no, your freedom is to wear bikini. Okay. So that's when they think in like, oh my God, she wants to be Westernized. She wants to pass the Western world values here. It's their own problem, really. If they think, if I want to drive a car, it's a Western thing. It's a human thing. It's a human right thing. It's not. So I don't really go through that argument with people who pass it that way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't go through these arguments.
I really like that. I really like just refusing to engage on
the terms. Yes, you're just wasting your time and energy. on these arguments. Mm-hmm. Because everyone will pass whatever judgment he wants to pass, no matter how much you explain to them that I'm calling for human rights, women's rights, and there's you're calling for bikinis and bars and going out with boyfriends. Like, you cannot even reason with that. And that's not even the Western values. I lived in the U.S. 1 year. They're more conservative than us. They're very conservative when it comes family values. They don't even, I've never heard vulgar language or cursing or swearing like I watch in Hollywood and in the TV. When I lived in New Hampshire, people were really conservative. People were really, I would say, not conservative in the religious way. I mean, in the values they have. And I was like, because when we watch as Muslim world, when we watch TV, the stereotypes, by the way, you have misconceptions about us. We have misconceptions about you too. my girlfriend was visiting me in Dubai. I wish she's here, Muslima. She's from Chicago. And she watched, what's the name of the, he's a black guy doing, impersonating a very fat woman. What's her name? Mattia? I can't even remember her name. I took her to the cinema. It was in Dubai, not in Saudi. We still don't have cinemas. And she looked at it. She said, "This is the type of movies you watch about us?" I said, "This is the type of movies you create." So we had also the misconception about what is the Western values. And it's sad that we don't even understand what's the Western values, like freedom of speech, freedom of belief, don't pass your judgment. I've never felt myself, but when I moved to the U.S., for the first time in my life, I was myself. I didn't have to live two lives to please the person in front of me. I was myself because no one passed their judgment on me. And this is a beautiful thing, and you have to value it in the U.S., and I hope you keep it because it does. It does. I wish it feels home. So when I moved to the U.S., it doesn't feel home because my home wasn't like this. I want it to be, it feels like my dream home when I moved here. So I think there is also misconception about Western values. This is why they use it as an accusation for feminism and activists.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Just really quick, so we have time for the book signing. I'll call this the last two questions.
I have a question which is not very well structured, so you will forget.
When
we talk about the equality between men and women, there's something which is always forgotten, in my view. It is the fact that women have fathers. And fathers, I mean, want the best for their daughters. Mm. I mean, I will be the fiercest fighter for the rights of my daughter. I want her to have absolutely, absolutely the same rights, I mean, as any boy. And I will fight for this. And I would imagine it should be the same in Saudi Arabia. So where are the men in Saudi Arabia? Where are the fathers? I mean, what's wrong with them?
But by the way, more and more men are supporting, more and more men are joining. My brother was totally against my divorce, for example. When I wanted to drive, which car I drove? And by the way, it was confiscated from him for a month. But men does now supporting. Large group, my group, when we started when we do campaigning, a lot of men, Saudi men, are joining it. More and more. I think we women also take part of the blame because when we fight for our rights, we don't think really of how important the men role and we don't prepare them. So you find men, the women in my country, more independent, more independent. They want to take decisions by themselves. And the men are not prepared for that because he thinks, I want someone like my mom. I saw my mom, she's obedient for my dad. I want my wife to be the same. So they're not prepared. The mothers also have to prepare. You remember the right to vote? The last man in that, when they voted for the woman right to vote in the U.S.? Anyone remember how it happened? It was Thai, and there was one guy, he would decide yes or no, woman will vote or not. His mom wrote to him, and he voted yes, because of his mom, not because of him. That's the role of woman when it comes to men. They prepare men, really. This is why we are also important to make men be more involved with us instead of looking at them as their enemies. They're our partners. Because believe me, men in Saudi Arabia suffer. Imagine one man with one salary. He's the one responsible for the whole household, his widowed mom, his sisters who are not married, his wife and daughters. They're sick of that, too. They want to change the system, too, now. Hi.
Hi. Thank you. I have totally different question. I was wondering how was Islam practiced before Saudi regime? Did you have the same rules before that? Before Saudi regime?
We didn't have Saudi Arabia. We had tribes in the Arabian Peninsula. The Hijaz, my family ruled the Hijaz. And it was open. So I remember reading the history books. We had all the sects of Islam, and they are taught in the holy mosque. So you find the Sufi, you find the Maliki, you find the Ismaili, the Shafi'i, all the sects being taught there in harmony, and they're living in harmony. There have been, of course, before Saudi Arabia, there have been a lot of the caliphate, the khilafah, like the Ottomans. They had to impose their version of Islam. It's always what the country or who's in power. Based on who's in power, the type of Islam that's been imposed. That's a problem.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. You're from Iran, right?
Yes, I am.
So we, yes. Saudi women and Iranian women, should unite. Because we face the same ideology.
In Iran, there is a different story because women had all these rights.
Yes.
Women could drive, vote, work, everything, and still have. But you made the right point that when Islamic Revolution happened in Iran, then Saudi regime start to become more
aggressive
because of the Shia and Sunni.
The competition between the two powers.
Yes, but they tried really hard to get away all these rights from women, but some of it took away for a while, a right to divorce, but then it came back again, so.
That's good.
Yes.
So, thank you.
Very quickly, do you see Mohammed bin Salman as a possible window towards helping women's rights in Saudi Arabia?
Yes, I do. A lot of Saudis attack me when I mention that. The guy is ambitious, and he's very smart. A lot of people are skeptical. But I believe we need a young leader who believes in change, and also the economical hardship that Saudi Arabia is going through. They cannot keep women out of the workforce and survive. They will go bankrupt in no time with the oil prices today and with the war in Yemen. So I believe that this man could create change in Saudi Arabia. Yeah. The war of Yemen is making the country go bankrupt in Saudi Arabia. This is why they're putting Aramco to be public next year. But he gets his pros and cons, but at least someone is taking an action now. At least someone is really believing in change and finally mentioning that women should be fully our untapped potential power for the economy. Always follow the money. Change is created when there is economy involved. When the World War II happened and women had to go to the factories and work, and when men came back, women said, I'm not staying home. I'm keeping my job. Follow the money. The economy, yes, you need the woman. And this will happen, the Industrial Revolution, and this country became a power when the women were involved in the workforce. They need it.
How about one more round of applause for Manal?
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.